Good afternoon. Good afternoon. So last time we started off by giving some examples of using those intrinsic functions that wrapped the SIMD instructions, which you hopefully now had practice with, at least from the lab yesterday. Then we talked about some operating system abstractions, namely the idea of a process, which we had said was a thread, which was the illusion you had your own processor, which we've created by actually dividing up a single processor core among multiple programs, switching between them with our operating system, using the mechanism of exceptions. And we call that time multiplexing, dividing up time on the processor. And via the second component of an address space, which is the illusion that your program has its own memory, which we created via address translation, that whenever the program accessed memory for any reason, reading instructions, data, using a pointer, it would actually go through this mapping that the operating system would carefully set up to make sure that the program can only access its own memory, not the memory of any other program. This was set up with the processor, and we're going to talk more today about what that mapping looks like. And we talked about exceptions. So exceptions, we mentioned, were how we implemented this time multiplexing idea. We had a program like my infinite loop, which didn't contain any instructions that would make it actually run the operating system. And yet, somehow, we needed the operating system to run because the operating system is responsible for switching to another program to give other programs the illusion they have some CPU time, that they aren't just left waiting forever. And the mechanism for that was this thing of an exception where the processor would jump to the operating system code even though there was no jump instruction saying to do that. And we mentioned that exceptions could be triggered by a whole bunch of things. And in the case of our time multiplexing scenario, the thing that triggered the exception was some external event, probably a timer expiring that the OS could configure before running my potentially infinite loop. And we mentioned that these also happen for things like I/O, for things that happen within programs. We have some exceptions which are triggered by a specific instruction, like privilege instructions, and also system calls, which I'll revisit in a bit. These are all things where the processor needs to ask the operating system for what help and what to do, and so it arranges to jump to it. And we talked about how that happened. And the first part is the operating system needed to tell the processor, where do you jump to? And the mechanism we gave for that was we had this exception table, which contained just this array of pointers to exception handlers. And both the exception table and the exception handlers would be created by the operating system with whatever pointers and code the operating system wanted there. And the operating system would set up the exception table base pointer, some register that the processor would let it set, to point to that. And it would use that whenever it detected any of the conditions, any of the many types of conditions that it calls an exception where it wants to run the operating system. We also talked about how this exception dispatch, especially for these exceptions which are triggered by events within a program, which we called synchronous exceptions, actually deal with out-of-order execution. So we'd like to pretend that the program executed up to the instruction that did some privileged operation, like access memory it's not supposed to. You know, so you can like debug it, for example. But we know we actually are executing the instructions out of order, and there might be a whole bunch of instructions after that that we didn't started executing, but we aren't supposed to have the values from. And there might be a whole bunch of instructions before that that when we detect the invalid access, we have already, you know, we haven't executed at all. So the way we dealt with that is we had this reorder buffer that kept a list of our instructions in order, and we just noted that there was an exception in there, And as we were doing our commit of instructions by going in order through that reorder buffer, we'd keep track of what the current register values are for committed instructions. And also we'd check, you know, that did an exception happen on this instruction? And if it did, we just copy those register values over to be our register value for new instructions. So when the operating system runs, it sees the register values from exactly where the exception was supposed to happen, especially for these ones which were triggered by a particular instruction, like a bad memory access or a system call. We also talked about sort of a protection issue, that we don't have to be the case that I get the illusion I have my own CPU, even if I try to do silly things like replace the exception table base pointer so I can run forever. Like, so I can make those interrupts not do anything to my program. I'm not supposed to be allowed to do that, and the processor has hardware support, so the operating system can do things like change the exception table or change the current address space mapping. But normal programs can't do it. And to support this, the processor can run in one of two modes, either user mode or kernel mode. And we enter kernel mode whenever we have an exception happen. So part of the jumping to the operating system is going to set this "we are in kernel mode" bit, and we exit via this special return from exception instruction. So in addition to figuring out how to jump back to the user program, we'll clear that kernel mode bit. And because the operating system writes all the exception handlers, and hopefully writes them very carefully, it gets to choose what happens in kernel mode. And as long as it doesn't make any mistakes, only what the operating system wants to happen in kernel mode happens in kernel mode. And so all the special privileged functionalities, like changing address spaces, accessing devices, and so on, only happen in the ways allowed by the OS. So any questions before we move on about things we covered last time? Okay. So last time we were talking about system calls and system call handlers as one of these types of exceptions. And I have these four categories here, which match what's in our textbook. We have these interrupts, these externally triggered events that come from things like timers, I/O devices, and this weird category of aborts. An example of an abort would be that some hardware can detect that memory is not holding the right value anymore, and it wants to tell the operating system about this, so it uses an exception to do that, and that would be an abort. We have these traps, these intentionally triggered exceptions, and the only example we really have are these system calls where we want the ask the OS to do something for us, and we know we need to have it happen in kernel mode, so we can't just call a function. And we have faults, which are errors or events in programs, like accessing memory not in your address space, divide by zero, privileged instructions, invalid instructions, things triggered by something about the instructions the program was running or trying to run. So these four categories, and I said that, you know, some of these are asynchronous, some of them are synchronous. Asynchronous ones aren't associated with a particular instruction. Synchronous ones are. And for the synchronous ones, we really care about matching the right instruction. Now, I didn't actually spend that much time going over all these names. And the big reason for that is that names like interrupt, abort, trap, and fault, those are very common names, but the real world is horribly inconsistent about terms for everything about exceptions you can think of. So I'm following the textbook's terms, but you might see, for example, if you read the x86 manual, they'll use the word interrupt for all the types of exceptions. Sometimes they'll use the word exception, but only to mean faults, only to mean those ones triggered by a particular error or event in the program. You'll sometimes see the word hard fault to mean abort, where it's not triggered by the program running, it's triggered by the hardware being broken. You'll sometimes see the word trap, meaning fault. Like, the terms are all over the place. And sadly, like, no one has agreed. Typically, what happens is different architecture manufacturers like write their manuals and use a particular set of terms. So Intel has terms they use, ARM has terms they use, everyone has different terms. So this means, practically speaking, that if you ever read anything about exceptions, you should try to look for context or definitions to figure out when they say interrupt, do they mean any exception? Do they mean I/O? What do they mean? You need context to know, because they could mean all of those things. It's just an unfortunate thing. So questions? Yeah. Question is, anyone trying to unite all the terms? So typically, a processor manufacturer will have a consistent set of terminology that they will use in all their documents. The issue is that each processor manufacturer has a different consistent set. So also, we use the term kernel mode, and there are some additional names for that. So you might see the words supervisor mode, or privileged mode, or ring zero. Also, there are some systems where there's not just kernel and user mode, but there's like a third mode or a fourth mode. There's more levels where there's something like in between kernel and user mode, which has less access than kernel mode, but more access than user mode. So that's a thing which exists. And these multiple levels of privilege are why you see names like ring zero. So XV6, sometimes kernel mode is called ring zero because user mode in the scheme is called ring three, and there's a one and a two, which are in between. And sometimes you'll see other in-between modes with different names. So just a warning that not everyone uses those terms, but if you like see supervisor mode or privileged mode, it probably means the same thing. Okay, so questions about this? Or any questions about exceptions, because we're not going to talk about exceptions for a while? Okay, so next topic is we're going to go into more detail about address translation. And remember, we had this idea that our program accesses some addresses, and it goes through this mapping to be turned into real addresses. And we're going to call the addresses the program accesses virtual address. And this includes everything the program accesses. There are not exceptions. There's no way of saying, I want to load this, but from a physical address. As a programmer, you only ever get to use virtual addresses. This is part of the illusion of having your own memory. We don't break that. All the addresses you can use go through this mapping. And note that this includes instructions. So your program counter is a virtual address that goes through this mapping to figure out where the code actually is. And we call the addresses in the real memory, we call those physical addresses. So we have these virtual addresses used in programs, which are mapped to physical addresses that are actually used by the actual memory. Because we have this mapping in the middle, these two addresses can be different sizes. And in fact, very commonly are different sizes.
Do you mean like lengthwise or depthwise?
I mean lengthwise in the sense that the number of bits in the address as written out will be different. So we have this mapping, and we're going to talk about what does this mapping look like, where is it stored today? And I'm going to start with a simplified example. So on our systems, we have gigabytes of memory and gigabytes of stuff our program can access. I'm going to make things much smaller to start out. I'm going to have a program with 10-bit virtual addresses. So there are 1 kilobyte of stuff it can access. And I'm going to divide up that 1 kilobyte into 4 256-byte pieces. And I'm going to call each of these pieces a page. I'm going to number them, starting from the lowest address and continuing. I'm going to call this a virtual page because it's virtual address. A set of virtual addresses makes up this virtual page. So I've just said that this part is virtual page 0, 1, 2, and 3. And I've also just arbitrarily decided that I'm going to put all the program's code in the first virtual page, all the program's data in heap in the second. But I didn't have to do that. That's just a choice I made. But I'm dividing up the program in addition to dividing up the memory. So these are our pages, and they're 2 to the 8 bytes. That's 256 bytes. These are the addresses the program will use. Yes?
Is that always true, or is that true in this example?
This is the size I have chosen. And it's not always the size we're going to use. Typically, we'll use a larger size, but we're keeping things small. So something to note about the size I chose, though. I chose a size that was a power of 2, and this was deliberate, because this means when I divide by that power of 2 to figure out which chunk we're in, all I'm doing is taking the high bits of the address. Dividing by 256 just cuts off those last 8 bits, so I figure out if I'm 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4 by just taking those top 2 bits. And that's going to be really convenient later on when we want to figure out, here's an address the program has, what chunk is it in? Which page? And we call that part of the address the page number, or in this case, a virtual page number, because it's a virtual address that is when the program gets to see. And we're going to have a name for the rest of the address, which is we're going to call that a page offset. So that tells us where in a particular page are we. So the bottom of the code is page offset 0, the top is page offset all ones, the bottom of the stack is page offset 0, the top is page offset all ones. It tells us where in the page are we, and because we have 2 to the 8 byte pages, we have, the 2 to the 8 possible things in the page we might want to access, so we need 8 bits to represent that, so our page offset is 8 bits. Okay. So questions about how I've divided this up and named the different pieces? Okay. So we're going to do the same thing to our physical addresses. So in this case, my hypothetical machine, we have a larger physical addresses. And I'm dividing my physical addresses into chunks of the same size, which I'm going to call pages again. But these aren't virtual pages, they're physical pages. And like with my virtual pages, I can just take the top bits, in this case, 3 of them, and that gives me a virtual page number. And I'm going to call the rest of the physical addresses the page offset. And the format that my mapping is going to take in this scheme is I'm just going to take these whole pages, these whole chunks of addresses that are virtual, and map them to a whole chunk of addresses that are physical. So I'm just going to draw some lines mapping, doing the mapping. And that's the format my mapping is going to take. Now, I'm not going to show the processor a picture. Doesn't know how to read pictures, probably. I'm going to have to represent this in some way the processor can understand. So it's going to look something kind of more like this. We'll get into more details about what the format is. But I just have a table representing the arrows I've drawn. And I have an entry for each virtual page. So each virtual page maps to one place, or no places in some cases. And I just have either the physical page number, or in one case, I didn't map it to anything, so I have none. And that none would be that invalid trigger and error thing that we talked about, where if you access memory that's beyond the end of your heap, you had a seg fault, that would be that area of memory was represented that way. And otherwise, we're saying that when the program accesses an address in here, actually access a physical address in here. So this table is called a page table. And we have just a list of physical pages, one for each possible virtual page. And they're just identified by the physical page number. And that's all we're storing in the table are these page numbers. So, questions about what I have here? Okay, so given that I have this table, I'm going to give this to the processor and it's going to use it. So here's a more concrete representation of that table. And I've added an additional field here. I've added this valid bit. And the reason I added this valid bit is, well, I have 0 through 7 as my possible physical page numbers, and I have 3 bits for my physical page number, so I don't have any leftover values. But I want to be able to represent this none entry here. So I have an extra bit saying, is the entry valid? If it is, the physical page number means something. If it's not, it doesn't matter what it is. We're not going to use it. So now I have 4 bits for each virtual page. I'm just going to store this somewhere. And this seems small enough that we could probably keep it on the processor. We'll talk later about what happens when it gets bigger. Yeah?
Wouldn't we never be trying to access that anyway?
The question is, wouldn't we never be trying to access that anyway? We never would deliberately probably do that, as far as we know so far. We'll have some reasons later on when we might do that. But when the operating system's running a program, it doesn't know the program isn't buggy.
Okay.
And it still needs to have set everything up for that.
Security thing.
So the question is, a security thing? Well, so a security is one consideration why we want to put something there. Though, from a security point of view, if I fill this in with any of the page numbers of the process, that's fine, right? The process is only hurting itself.
Okay, that's fair.
The main reason to do it is more of a correctness sort of thing. Like, even if we think the program shouldn't access that, we'd like to detect that and give a segmentation fault message rather than, you know, letting the program do something really weird. So we have this table. Now we're going to use it for the program's access. So the program gets an address that it wants to use. It comes from the CPU, either for fetching an instruction or for accessing memory. And it's one of these 10-bit addresses. And we're going to take off the bits which represent the virtual page number and look up the appropriate row in this table. In this case, the row with number 01. And we're going to look up what's called a page table entry from this row, which we looked up with our virtual page number. So we take our page table entry and we get it out of this table. And we get 2 things. We get its valid bit, and we're going to check that valid bit. And if it's 0, we're going to trigger an exception so the operating system can do print a segmentation fault or whatever else it wants to do if we access invalid memory. And we're also going to take our physical page number, and we're going to put that as part of our address. And we're going to copy over, you know, so our physical page number is part of our address, and the rest is going to be our page offset, which we're just going to copy from the original address, because we're going to go to the same part of the physical page as the part of the virtual page we're trying to get to. And once we get the physical page number and the page offset combined together, we'll send that value to our cache, and our cache will actually do the memory access. Okay. So a question, yes?
You're talking about like telling you different sizes. How would that be handled if the page offset from the program memory was different than the length of the page offset of the physical address?
So the question is, what if the page offset for the virtual addresses and the physical addresses were different? We're not going to allow that in this scheme. So in order for the virtual and physical address to have different sizes, the size of the virtual page number and the physical page number must be different. And that's where all the difference will be accounted for. Okay, other questions? Okay, so if you remember from last time, we talked about some things related to changing between different address space mappings. And one thing we mentioned is that, you know, we have these privileged instructions to do that, that we're not going to allow normal user programs to do it. Now, the thing is that when the processor is executing code, it's using the current mapping. And the code that changes the mapping has to be, therefore, in the table. Right? Because it's going to fetch an instruction. It's going to go through this procedure to figure out where to fetch the instruction from. So that code which changes that mapping has to be in the table, in memory, somewhere, in specified by the table. So there has to be a page table entry that points to that code. And we'd like a way of making it only kernel mode, because we don't want, you know, the user program to decide, oh, I'm going to change that code to change the page table to a different thing. We don't want the user program to edit that code. And to support this, we're going to have a way of triggering an error if you try to use a page table entry outside of kernel mode. And to do that, we're going to do something very similar to this valid bit. We're just going to add an extra bit to each page table entry, which is it kernel mode only? So here I've said virtual page 1.1 has the OS's stuff in it, so it's marked as kernel mode only. And we're going to do the same lookup we did before, but in addition to checking if the valid bit is 0, we're also going to check if the kernel bit disagrees with our user mode flag. And if it does, we'll trigger an exception. Okay. So, our questions? Yeah. So in the model I showed you so far, when we started back here, I told you every address code accesses goes through this mapping. And to stop that, we need to change the mapping.
Okay.
So the way of undoing that is a privilege instruction that needs to run while this mapping is still in place. And so that's why we have this problem. An alternate solution might be that we have like part of the memory which is kernel mode only, but not doesn't use the page table. And there's some processors which do that instead. But you need something so you can run the code despite having the mapping still in place. Or another alternative would be we could have the processor, as part of starting an exception handler, change the page table. But then we need to say, what do you change it to? And all that sort of question. So the most common solution is instead something like this, where you just say, the code's going to be in the page table, but we're going to mark it only kernel mode so it doesn't get messed with. Okay. So other questions? So we have some extra bit. So now we have a way of changing our page tables without, you know, despite the fact it's a privileged instruction, without letting programs decide what to change it to correctly. Now, so that's our basic scheme. And now we're going to talk about, you know, the realities of this with, you know, normal addresses. So one thing you might think is, okay, so we talked about the size of virtual and physical addresses being different, but you might say, well, I know on my 64-bit systems, my virtual addresses are 64 bits because that's the size of my pointers. And I know on my 32-bit system, they're 32 bits because that's the size of my pointers. And often that's true, but sometimes only part of the pointer is used. So for example, typical x86-64 systems, they're 64-bit, the registers are 64-bit, your pointers are 64-bit, but only 48 bits of that address is actually used to figure out what value to send to the cache. Some of the bits are ignored. The rule in 64-bit x86 is that some of the high bits always just have to be the same as the signed bit, and they're just not sent to the cache and not used in the page table at all. And when we talk about the size of a virtual address in this class, generally we mean the size that's actually used for the mapping to a physical address. So there might be other bits in your pointer, but we won't consider them part of the virtual address if there's one of these unused bits that are just filler, because typically we want our registers to be a power of 2 size, not like 48 bits. Another consideration and reason why x86 does this is that they can have 64-bit pointers, but they can change how much of the mapping is used as they make new processors, so they can keep the size smaller until they're worried about like having terabytes of memory. And in fact, some newer x86 processors up this 48 to like 50-something. That gives you room for flexibility. So also sometimes we'll talk about the size of an address space, which is the amount of stuff that can be addressed. But when we're talking about that, usually we mean the number of unique addresses. So we'll say something with a 32-bit physical address has if it's byte addressed, has 2 to the 32 byte address space. But that doesn't mean that all of those 2 to the 32 addresses point to anything you can use. We'll say we have that size address space, even if we know that large parts of that are likely to be invalid. Similarly, if we have a 20-bit physical address, we'll say we have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address space because we can name 2 to the 20 distinct locations there. But it might be the case that we can't use all of that. So for example, if I have a machine with 3 gigs of memory, that's not a power of 2. But we're going to say my address space is based on the size of the address I use, even though clearly some of those addresses are not so useful. Because either they don't refer to real memory, or like some part of memory has 2 addresses or something like that. And this is the most common situation. Like typically your CPU supports like more physical addresses than you actually have memory for. But when we talk about the address space size, we mean the number of possible addresses, not the number of ones that are actually useful. This is a terminology clarification, because otherwise, because I know it's like, you really do want it to be the case that physical addresses is the size of memory. This is not what we mean when we talk about physical address space. Okay, so questions on this idea? Address spaces and sizes. Okay, so let's talk about some more realistic sizes and schemes. So let's say I have 32-bit virtual addresses and I have 4,096 byte pages, or 2 to the 12 bytes. And this is what 32-bit x86 uses. So first question, figure it out. How many virtual pages? I'll give you like 30 seconds, check with your neighbor. How many virtual pages are there? Yes? 2 to the 32. So there are 2 to the 32 bytes. Bytes. But that's not the number of virtual pages. Yeah.
Oh.
What?
2 to the 7.
2 to the 7? How did you get that?
2 to the 12 over 2.
2 to the 12 over, why 2 to the 5? Yeah.
2 to the 20th, because we have 232 to account for, but each page is 2 to the 12th.
Yeah.
So each 2 to the 20th, 2 to the 12 sections in a 2 to the 32.
Yeah. So we have chunks which are 2 to the 12 bytes, and 2 to the 32 total bytes among those chunks. So we divide up and figure out how many chunks we have. the pages. So you have 2 to the 20 virtual pages. So let's do a little more complicated thing here. So let's say I have 32-bit virtual addresses and 30-bit physical addresses. And again, I have 2 to the 12 byte pages. And I have page table entries which have the physical page number, a valid bit, and a kernel mode bit, and that's it. So I've shown you sort of what's in the page table. So if we lay out the page table the way I just showed you, how big is the page table for this system? And as a reminder, remember that when we took our address, we had our 32-bit address, and we split that up into our virtual page number and our page offset, and we are going to do the same thing with our physical address. I'll give you a minute or two to figure this out. I would advise, check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the size should be. Needs more time? So who can volunteer an answer? Preferably someone who hasn't spoken. Or a partial answer. Or tell me what the first step I should do is. Looking for someone who So you had 24 times 2 to the 20th. So let's start with what's the times 2 to the 20th from?
Okay, so that is the number of entries, right? We have an entry for each virtual page number that makes it to the right physical page number.
Entry for each virtual page number, and we mentioned that we had 2 to the 20 virtual pages.
Right.
So that's right. So how about, so first of all, so in the other part, let's go.
Yeah. So then if we have 32 bits in our virtual address and 20 of those bits are the page number, the last 12 bits are the
page offset.
And then we have the same offset in the 30 bit. So I actually got the wrong answer, but I'll through it now. So 30 minus 12 would be 18. So we have 18 in the 30 bit, bits in the physical page.
Yeah,
page. So then that plus the 20, we have 38. Plus 2 for the valid bit, the kernel bit, is 40 times 2 to the 20th.
So our first step, as mentioned, is that we look at how these addresses are split up, and we know we have 12 bits for the page offset, and the rest is a page number. And for the physical page number, we look at the physical address, which we know is 30 bits in total, minus 12 gives us 18 bits for the physical page number. So this is 18 bits. This is 1 bit for the valid bit and 1 bit for the kernel mode bit. So that's 20 bits for a page table entry. So we get 20 bits times 2 to the 20th, which is going to be, you know, a little more than 2 megabytes. Because remember, this is 2 to the 20 bits is not a number of bytes. So a little more than 2 megabytes. So any disagreement, questions? Yes.
Why did you say that it was 40 times 2 to the
20? Because I added 18 plus 2 is not 40, because I can't just own that.
Yeah, but it should be 20. Yes, math problems are not very important. Yeah.
So does the page table entry not also include the virtual page number?
Question is, does the page table entry not also include the virtual page number? Correct. So, and I've tried to represent that by not having it in the box here. So we know what the virtual page number is just by where it is in the table. So yes, we indeed do not need to store the virtual page number. And because we're thrifty about storage for our hardware, we're not going to do that, especially if we're getting numbers like 2 megabytes. Already. Okay, so second sort of problem with this. So let's say I have an address like this. And I have my 4 kilobyte and 2 to the 12 byte pages. What is actually, for this specific address, what is the page number and page offset? I'll give you like a bit of time. Any volunteers with an answer? A partial answer? Yeah.
So the page offset would be the lowest 3 hex characters.
Okay.
So 0x678.
Is the page offset? Okay. And the page number?
The page number would be the
rest of it. So how did you know it was the lowest 3 for the page offset? Yeah, so this is 4 bits, so 3 of them is 12 bits, and we know that the layout is that we have page offset, page number, and this is 12 bits. We got 12 because it's the size of the pages, and the rest, and this is, we don't actually know how big the virtual page number is, but it doesn't matter. We just get rid of the page offset, and what's left over is the virtual page number. Okay, so any questions about this? Okay. So here we said that we had, for this case, about 2 megabytes of page table. And this seems a bit problematic because, you know, before, if you looked at this, you could believe, like, we could store that like in a register in our processor. That's pretty straightforward. It's not that much data. And we could like change that every time we switch processes and it won't be a big deal. But if we're talking about like changing 2 megabytes every time we change processes, that's a big deal. We want to change processes in a much shorter time scale. Yeah.
Sorry, is the setup where we have like one entry for each virtual page number plus one valid bit plus one kernel bit. Is that like the standard setup that we're going to be tested on? Like, should I write that down, or is that like?
So we will. So question is, do we have this setup? We will specify what page table layout when we need it.
Okay.
We'll have. We will gradually make this more and more complicated. So I'm starting with something simple.
Okay.
So here I have 2 megabytes. So I can't just afford to like change that in my processor every time I context switch, because then my context switches are really slow. I'm copying 2 megabytes from somewhere. Also, I need to keep 2 megabytes like in the processor. And if you remember, we aren't willing to like have like a 1/4 megabyte L1 cache. We probably really aren't willing to access 2 megabytes of data for normal memory accesses. Now, so we need some better way of storing these page tables. And our solution is going to be, we're going to keep them in memory. So I have an example with a smaller address here. But we'll just choose some way to represent each page table entry in memory. In this case, I'm choosing to represent it as a 16-bit integer. And I've just decided that the bit 15, the most significant bit of that 16-bit integer, is what I'm going to put the valid bit, then the kernel bit, then I'm going to use these bit, there are some bits after that for the physical page number. And while I chose a 16-bit integer, I didn't have 16 bits of stuff, I'm just going to leave some bits unused. I'd say, why am I wasting space? Well, it sure would be inconvenient to access, you know, some part of memory, but 4, 3 bytes in to find my page table entry. So by doing this, all my page table entries start, you know, there's 1 every 2 bytes, not 1 every 1 byte and 6 bits, which would make it very complicated to find a particular page table entry. And when you look at real processors, typically they will use page table entry sizes that are a power of 2 for this reason, even if that means we have some unused space here. And I'm going to store this in memory. And for now, we're just going to store this as a big array. And to access an array, well, I need to know, where does the array start? So in my processor, I'm going to have a register that just points to where does the array start. I'm going to call this the page table base register. And rather than changing the whole table on a context switch, we'll just change this pointer to the table. And this will point to our memory, where we'll have just a whole bunch of, I'm showing here 2-byte values in memory. Memory's really byte addressable, but I'm just showing the 2-byte pairs of values. And we know that the valid bit of virtual page 0, for example, is the most significant bit of that 2-byte value that it points to. The kernel bit of that page table entry is the second bit. Then we have the physical page number of that first page table entry. And immediately after this first page table entry is the second page table entry, the one for virtual page number 1, then 2, and so on. So our memory just holds this page table, but in the form of 2-byte values rather than as an explicit table like this. But that's what's represented by the contents of memory. So for example, the most significant bit of all those of that array of 2-byte integers are all the valid bits in our page table. Yes, question? So the question is, who's doing this translation? So the processor is going to read, so the processor is going to have this page table base register.
Right.
And a subtlety I didn't mention is that it contains a physical address. This is physical memory, and this is a physical address it contains. Because we better not be doing a page table lookup to find our page table. That's not going to work out very well. We'll then do a page table lookup to find the page table. To find the page table, won't work. So it contains a physical address, and the processor itself is going to do this lookup, use this, going to figure out how many bytes into here, find the address of whatever virtual address we're using, and read that entry.
So we don't write this into our code, right? Like, when we write assembly, we don't write this part. Would it be in
So the question is, where does the processor implement this?
Yes.
And micro operations would be a typical choice. Now, we'll talk later on about making this fast, and we'll learn that there's that. So for now, we're going to say that the processor does this lookup all the time. We'll talk later on about what really happens, because it turns out doing that all the time would be a bit slow. But yeah, we have this table in here, and note that the table has a size, which is based on, in this case, the number of virtual addresses. And given the virtual address, you know, you can get the page number, you can figure out what memory address to go to, and the processor is going to do that computation. And it's going to read out this 2 bytes, it's going to check the valid bit, it's going to check, get the physical page number. Yes?
Okay, so we have to do this to get to main memory, but once something is loaded into the cache, are we accessing it with its virtual address or with its, like,
so the question is, how are we accessing the cache? And we will answer that question on this slide, where I'll go through the process. So what's going to happen is that we're going to take our virtual page number. We need to figure out where in the table it is. So you need to figure out how many bytes into the table is it. So we'll multiply the virtual page number part of the address by the size of each page table entry. So in this case, 2 bytes. And then I'll add it to my page table base register. This is just, how do I get to array out that array element given the array has, you know, 2 byte entries? We're just computing the address of the array element. So once we get that, we're going to send that address to our data or instruction cache. And we're going to get out our page table entry. And we're going to split that up into its parts. So one of the pieces is going to be the physical page number. And some of the other pieces are going to be things like the valid bit and the kernel bit, which we'll check as before to see if we want to cause a fault, ask the OS what to do. And then, like before, we'll copy the page offset from the original virtual address, combine it with that page number, and get a physical address, and we'll send that back to the cache. So that's what we'll talk about now. So you might observe we could do this in a way where, like, we do this after the cache, but for now, and most processors, conceptually at least, do this before the cache access.
Okay. So the tag in the cache is the physical address.
Yeah, so the cache here is only seeing physical addresses.
Okay.
And also, the cache is hopefully making this not so bad by caching parts of our page table. So there's this procedure, and as I said, the hardware is going to do this translation for us. And we'll call the part of the hardware which does this the memory management unit. So any questions about what's in this picture? Yes?
When we're multiplying by the page table entry size, is it multiplying by, like, the number of bits in the virtual address for the page number, or, like, the actual bits?
So the question is, what's being multiplied here?
In the virtual address, is the page table entry size being multiplied by the number of bits in the purple part, or, like, the actual?
It's being multiplied by this value.
Okay.
Yeah, just the page number is being multiplied by that, because the page number is our array index.
It's just being shifted, right?
So the question is it just being shifted? Yeah, so processors choose the page size to be a power of 2 so that multiply can be a shift, which is a lot faster. Okay, so we have this translation, and part of this translation means that one cache or memory access has now become 2. And this is kind of a problem, because if we think about our whole pipeline, remember that instructions can access memory twice, to fetch and to do the load or store, and now that can turn into 4 times. So this is challenging to make fast, and we're going to talk in the future about making this fast. The preview is it involves more caches. We're going to have even more caches than we have now. Okay, so I'd like to talk about another bit of a challenge. So let's talk about my desktop's memory. So my desktop has 39-bit physical addresses and 48-bit virtual addresses and still has 4K, that's 2 to the 12 byte pages. So how large are, how many page table entries do I have and how large are page numbers? Give you a bit of time. Figure this out. It's the same procedure as we had for the prior problem. So. So, anyone have answers to any part? So, you say 2 to the 36, how did you get that?
So, there's 48-bit virtual addresses, and then because each page is 12 bits.
Okay. Yeah. So, this is one per virtual page number. So each virtual page number in the scheme we've seen so far has its own page table entry. And any answers for the second part? How large are the physical page numbers? No. Yeah.
So 36 bits are spent on,
Okay, you could figure it out that way. So we have our physical page number and physical address, and we have our virtual page number and page offset.
Page number, 12-bit offset, 39 minus 12 is 27-bit physical page number.
But the way, I like drawing the picture of like how's the address split up. So we have 27, to make this whole, because we know this whole thing is 39 because we were just, or not 30, because we were told that. So we end up with 27 bits here. So, and I just have that pre-written down. I'll just write again. This is entries, this is one per VPN. Okay, and that means that if it's 27-bit physical page number, my page table entries need to be at least 28 bits because we need a valid bit in addition to that, and possibly a bit larger. And it turns out that they're actually 8 bytes, because there's a whole bunch of other things Intel wanted to include there. Also, they wanted to make it possible to make the physical addresses bigger in the future. So they're 8 bytes. So if we say we have 8-byte page table entries and 2 to the 36 of them, that would take up 2 to the 39 bytes, which is 512 gigabytes. Now, it won't surprise you to know that my desktop does not have 512 gigabytes of memory, and certainly does not have 2 or 3 times 512 gigabytes of memory, and yet I can run 2 or 3 programs at a time, actually many more than that. So clearly, something is going on where we're not storing page table entries in this way. We're doing something else. So these are two big problems we're going to solve in later classes. So one is the extra cache accesses are going to make things slow. So our solution for that is we're going to have more caches. And the other thing is that it seems like our page tables need to be really huge, like 2 megabytes. It's big. It's manageable. But 512 gigabytes, clearly we can't do. And our solution for that is that we're going to end up with a structure which is a little more complicated than a flat table. in order to not store some redundant information. But for now, let's go through a little exercise here. So I'm going to have, I have, in this case, a page table that's not stored in memory here. And I have a contents of physical memory. And my physical memory, I'm dividing up into these 8-byte pages. And I have, so I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them. So I have 3-bit physical page number, 3-bit page offset, to figure out which of those 8 bytes. So I have 6-bit physical addresses, and I have 5-bit virtual addresses. And I'd just like you to take these addresses and do the translation and tell me, if I load from that address in my program, what value am I going to get? What byte am I going to read? I'll give you a minute or two, a couple minutes to do this. Check with your neighbor. And I would write things down. You might do this all in your head, but I would probably get answers wrong if I did that. One byte. You can talk to each other, it's okay. Especially check answers if you agree. Okay, someone willing to explain any one answer? I think they have any one of the answers. Yeah.
I think you're the first one.
Okay.
So it's 0001100 for the...
Yeah, so first you want to convert this to binary. So that was your idea. So we have 1 and then 1000. So this is the 8 part and this is the 1 part. Okay.
So then we go to our virtual page table entry. It's the last one.
So why is it the last one?
Because 1, 1.
So yeah, so this is our 3-bit page offset. And therefore the remaining part is our virtual page number, which is 2 bits. So that checks. So we get this page table entry.
Valid, so we go to the 0.
Okay, so then we have to turn this into a physical address, so the physical page number part of it is all zeros, and we copy the page offset, and as you said, that gives us the 0th byte, which is right here. So questions about anything we did there? Yeah. The second set of zeros I copied from here. If you mean this, that's the beginning of the address, and this part I copied is exactly just, is the page offset, which I just got from my virtual address. So I have the page number, the physical page number came from my page table, the page offset came from the original virtual address. Other questions? Yeah. So question is, why am I choosing this 00 and not something else in that same page? So the number I got here is all zeros, which is address 0. And in this table, the way it's laid out, which I probably should have explained, is that this is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, OXA, OXB, OXC, and so on. So we just translate this binary back to hexadecimal, and we get 0x00, and that's exactly where that is. That makes sense? So the question is, you said OX18 has 3 zeros at the beginning, which I didn't write down. So first of all, I told you in the question that we have 5-bit virtual addresses. So the addresses are really only 5 bits. And so you're probably saying, why didn't you write an 8-bit thing? Well, I was writing it in hex, and I didn't really have an option of writing something that wasn't a multiple of 4 as far as, like, how many bits it naturally corresponds to. But also, like for this, for OX3 here, I could have written for OX03, like if I wrote OX3, it would mean the same thing. Leading zeros, like, are just a thing we're gonna, you know, have to deal with.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, but this is that was just like 2 hexadecimal digits was the best way of writing that number in hex. Yeah.
How much are we extracting from the memory? Are we extracting a whole byte?
So in this case, it's byte, and I should have written that down. Obviously, in a real processor, we'd probably typically be extracting more, though a real processor probably has larger than 6-bit physical addresses. But here, it's just a byte. Yeah. So you're saying, why do we ignore? So this is the range of physical addresses on this line. So this contains 4 bytes. This line has 4 values of 4 bytes. Each of those bytes has a unique physical address. So we're saying that that contains the bytes with address 0 through 3, and say over here contains the bytes with address hex 24 to hex 27, inclusive. other questions? And I'm sorry, I probably should have gone through what this diagram was representing to begin with, since it's not entirely obvious. I'm trying to save space on my slide by not like writing everything out. Other questions? Okay, anyone who can tell me about the second problem, the address 0x03. Anyone has the answer for 0x03? Yeah.
Was your like 4A?
4A. So you got 4A, and how did you get that? So what page table entry did you use?
Did the first one, because it's 03, so then the two virtual page number bits would be 00.
Yeah, so we have 00011 is our virtual address. The top two bits are our page number, and we look up and we find out that we have 010 is the physical page number. So we substitute that for the virtual page number and keep the same page offset. And if we translate this back to hexadecimal, we find out that we have 323 is the address, or 13, because I can count digits, is the address, which is this 4A right here. Any questions about that? Okay.
Wait, what is that number on the left?
Or? Which number? This is a 1. This should be a 1. We'll make that clear. So this is a 3 and a 1. And that's just converting back to hexadecimal. So I can use the table more easily. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so how about the last and the next one? You get DC there. How about the last one? What happens for that? Yeah.
So when you convert it into binary, you get the virtual page as 10, which is 1 invalid.
Yeah, so for that one, you try to use this page table entry. There's a physical page number in it, but we don't care. It's invalid, and it's going to result in a fault when you try to access it. Okay, so for last topic for today, let's talk about something else we'd like to do with page tables. Let's say I have a shared machine, and we're both running copies of, say, Emacs. And something you'll note is that we're doing different things with Emacs, and user XYZ here is using a lot more memory in their Emacs, but we have some stuff in here which is the same. For example, we have this code that's the Emacs binary, which should be the same for both users, and we'd sure like to only keep one copy in memory. And we can do that with our page table. We can just have the two page tables for these programs point to the same physical pages. But there's a problem with that. What if Emacs has some bugs, and sometimes it accidentally modifies its code? And because of that, we can't just have them have that, because it would break our illusion of its own memory. We'd somehow start noticing, I don't actually have my own memory because I'm seeing bugs from other copies of the same program. So a solution to that is going to be the same idea as the kernel mode only bit. We'll add more bits, like saying if it's writable. And we'll check them the same way as the kernel mode and the valid bit, that when we do a page table access, we'll see, are we doing a write? If so, make sure the write bit is set. If not, trigger an exception. And in this way, we can safely share this data between the two programs and not keep two copies of it, but also not worry about like bugs from one process affecting another. And we can extend this idea to shared libraries, that we can have one copy of printf in memory and load it into all our programs, and we don't have to worry about a program messing up and overwriting printf, because we make the page table entries that point to it be marked not writable, and our memory management unit, when it does that page table lookup, it's not only going to check the valid bit and the kernel bit, it's going to check that write bit based on whether or not we're doing a write, and maybe cause an exception. Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish for today. Sorry for going a little over.